This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
What is it for and how does it work?
Well, the arts tax was voted on last November by voters here in the Portland area. And the idea was a citywide tax. It was $35 per person to pay for arts education in the elementary levels of the six school districts that are contiguous with Portland, Portland Public plus the five smaller ones, and also to help fund, secondarily, the arts community through the RAC, or the Regional Arts Council. The original deadline was April 15th, but we pushed it back to May 15th.
Can you talk about that? Why was it pushed back an additional month?
Because as this mayor came in January, and as this new, brand new, heretofore untried tax was coming together, almost immediately staff discovered a problem with it. And the problem that they discovered was that the way it was written, a household with median income above the federal poverty line, everybody had to pay the $35 per person. Well, that meant if your daughter was a dog watcher and made $10 last year, she was expected to pay $35 of that $10 to the arts tax. Clearly, that's not what anybody intended. So the mayor stopped in March and said, all right, let's fix that. Let's take it to council. Let's change that, create a floor, because clearly that was the law of unintended consequences. So that change happened, and a floor of $1,000 was added. Because that was a physical change to it, the mayor and the city council said, you know, let's give people more time. Let's push the deadline from April 15 to May 15. So then April rolled around, and the legal staff, the city lawyers, and the revenue people brought yet another problem to it. The way it was written, they found a second flaw in it. And the second flaw was, as written, one could assume that they would have to pay their $35 if their income came from Social Security or PERS, or the federal variation of PERS. Well, in fact, cities in Oregon cannot tax Social Security nor PERS. So that was a problem. So again, even though we had already moved the deadline once, we found yet another problem with the way that the tax was written, which we then had to address, hey, folks, if you paid, but all of the money you made last year came from Social Security or PERS, we got to give that money back to you.
Yeah, just to clarify what you were saying, so we're talking here about income earners, not just the median within a single household, yes?
That is correct.
Okay, and I know that there are some other issues with the website kind of getting overloaded and shutting down in the past couple of days. Could you explain what happened with that?
Yes, we here in the mayor's office, we've liked to refer to the arts tax as the gift that keeps on giving, because every couple of weeks something else goes kablooey that's associated with the arts tax. This time what happened was, as we approached that deadline, lots and lots and lots of people decided they should pay it. In fact, they were estimating that 230,000 people had paid the tax, and it was coming together quite well. That collection was better than a lot of us had anticipated. But what happened was, apparently people trying to sign in to pay it online overloaded the computer, and the computer had a massive slowdown. So on Wednesday night, we sent out an email to all of our media friends that said, that website is not working. Because that website is not functioning, we're going to suspend the deadline, the May 15th deadline, indefinitely until we can figure out what our technical problem is.
And finally, although people making less than $1,000 a year are tax exempt, because it is a flat tax and does not correlate with income, it affects poor people more than people who make more money. Do you have any comments on that situation?
The mayor is not happy about how regressive that the tax is. He didn't like it last year, even though he voted for it. The regressive nature of it was known. People lobbied for and against it last year, saying it was regressive, and the voters still passed it by a pretty large margin. So that seems to be hard-baked into what the electorate wanted. But because we have found, so far, two structural flaws, the city council has asked the revenue department to come back in July, after all the collections is done, and say, let's pop the hood on the entire arts tax, look at it soup to nuts, figure out what works, figure out what doesn't. That includes, by the way, the website, as well as the structural writing of the tax itself. And then make a decision about how much can we change and still be true to the electorate. So the needle that you need to thread here is we need to be true to taxpayers, and we need to be true to the voters that okayed this thing.
This is Jennifer Kemp with KBOO News.
A judge ruled that negotiations meetings between TriMet and the Amalgamated Transit Union 757, or the ATU, do not need to be open to the public. Judge Leslie Roberts did say that as a matter of right, both groups can invite parties to observe as long as there is a final agreement over the guest list. The ATU will appeal the decision, arguing that negotiations should be open to everyone.
Tomorrow is the last day for public comment on a proposed geothermal drilling project in Central Oregon. Ormat Nevada Incorporated, a Nevada-based company, applied for permits to explore 16 geothermal sites near Glass Buttes, Oregon. The projects would involve drilling, testing, and monitoring of the proposed sites to evaluate the potential of the geothermal resources. The Bureau of Land Management released an environmental impact statement declaring a finding of no significant impact on the proposed project sites. Rachel Bennett spoke with Dan Morse, conservation director with Oregon Natural Desert Association.
What are some of the methods that would be used in the proposed geothermal projects?
Currently, the proponent, Ormat, is their name, they're proposing exploratory drilling at the site near Glass Buttes, off of Highway 20. And the exploratory drilling would use something called thin wells, potentially smaller diameter holes in the ground with a smaller acreage cleared for the well pad. And they would drill those holes to test the temperature of the water that would be used perhaps to do geothermal energy generation.
What are the potential environmental impacts?
So with anything, any type of activity, whether it's geothermal exploration or roads or power lines in sagebrush steppe habitat, to put in a facility, you're going to have to disturb the surface of the ground, and that might amount to clearing out sagebrush, grasses, putting in a road. And those sorts of things can impact sage grouse and other species who don't like to be near disturbance, things like noise. They don't like to have fragmentation in their habitats, meaning roads cutting through and things that are difficult for them to cross because of use or because of lack of cover. And those are the sorts of impacts that could result from both the exploration activity or the eventual development of a geothermal facility.
Are there any concerns that you have as a conservation organization about potential impact on wildlife habitat?
There are areas around Glass Buttes that are identified and documented as core habitat for sage grouse. And because of the status of the sage grouse, the potential that it would be listed under the Endangered Species Act, we have significant concerns about any impacts in those core habitat areas.
I've been speaking with Dan Morse, Conservation Director with Oregon Natural Desert Association. This is Rachel Bennett with KBOO News.
This Sunday, Pioneer Courthouse Square is the chosen venue for what organizers dub a fair for a fair economy, where chances to, quote, soak a banker can and will be made available. The fair is a result of three-way partnership between the labor advocacy group Portland Rising, the Service Employees International Union, and social justice collective We Are Oregon. Cable reporter Robin Ryan spoke with SEIU member Steve Demarest about what he hopes folks will enjoy and learn at the event.
Steve, can you tell me why there's going to be a fair for a fair economy?
It's one way to mobilize our members and to mobilize the public in the fight for a fair economy. And it's a way that I think is going to be both interesting and fun. It's a way to get information out there, a way to get it public. And it's also a way, frankly, to get some more pressure on the governor and those who can do something about a fair economy and take the steps in the right direction.
And where will this fair be held? When?
Sunday, May 19th. It's at Pioneer Square. It's from 1:30 to 3:30. Fair in Portland's living room. We invite everyone to come down, have some fun. We're going to make it entertaining and while getting our message out.
What kinds of activities can people attend and expect to see?
We're going to try to make it a fair-like atmosphere, so we'll have some actions like Soak the Banker, opportunity for people to put someone who resembles a banker into a dunk tank. There'll be some short speeches, and then we're going to try to take some actions, encourage people to join us. We'll leave from the fair, and we're going to have a march onto Nike, which is located nearby, and then a march onto a nearby bank.
There is an educational component indicated within the program that you'll be offering. What is it that you hope folks in attendance will be learning?
We hope that they learn that Oregon's been ripped off by Wall Street and by corporations, and that there's something that can be done about that. Oregon can take action against companies that cost the state of Oregon hundreds of millions of dollars, and they can get some of that money back. And, in fact, I encourage your listeners to go to getoregonsmoneyback.org and read about this attempt to get some of our money back and to sign an online petitioner for the governor. Every month that we wait to take any legal action, the state loses money due to statutes of limitations. So it's something that Oregon should have moved on already, but because they haven't, they should move as soon as possible. We also hope to educate people about what SEIU and our partner organizations are doing to promote a fair economy and get us all back on track.
What do you think is going to take for the folks who have put the economy in this state for them to be dissuaded from doing it again?
Well, I think there has to be consequences for their actions. If they can get away with it, there's really no reason for them not to do it again if it's going to fatten their wallets. So there has to be financial consequences for the corporations and individuals that are responsible. And when they commit crimes, there has to be repercussions for that, and that includes criminal sanctions. If it's a serious enough crime, that may even include jail time. But we can't continue to let these people and corporations go off scot-free, or they're going to continue to do it.
This is KBOO News, and I'm Robin Ryan.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales has declared that he will continue to fund the Crisis Assessment and Treatment Center for people suffering from mental health crises. The center was originally slated to close as part of the $21 million in budget cuts proposed by Mayor Hales. The Mental Health Center opened in June 2011. It's located in the heart of Northeast Portland. Multnomah County agreed to fund 20% of the $3.5 million operating cost. Since it opened, the center has helped to stabilize about 1,300 people in mental health crises. Roughly 950 of their patients came from emergency departments, most of whom had been dropped there by police. Police have failed to use the center effectively, but the mayor says this doesn't mean it should close. Instead, police need to be better trained and have better communication with the staff at the treatment center to use it as it was intended. Staff at the center say it provides a vital alternative to jail and hospital emergency rooms for people suffering from acute mental health crisis.
An inmate at the Cowlitz County Jail in Washington State died yesterday after being stun-gunned by police in an altercation that led to her arrest. This past Sunday, 28-year-old Jenny Lynn Borellis was shot with a stun gun by a police officer attempting to bring her in on multiple Department of Correction warrants. The officer claims that his use of the stun gun was motivated by the knowledge that Borellis was an intravenous drug user likely to be carrying needles and that she had refused to comply with his request to stop. As she fell, she hit her head and was subsequently examined at a Longview hospital. Having been cleared of life-threatening injury, she was taken to the county jail, but returned to the hospital after falling ill on Wednesday. She died at Southwest Washington Medical Center on Thursday afternoon.
I think the human rights framework is useful
in terms of the ability that it gives us to look at.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, we'll celebrate 35 years on the KABU airwaves by welcoming Bread and Roses founder Susan Dobroff and 90s Collective member Pamela Pegg. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, rainy with temperatures in the 60s and a chance of showers throughout the rest of the weekend.
It's 5:20, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
My state of Texas seems to have an inordinate share of nincompoops in public office. But it's only fair that office holders from other states be considered before deciding which one is the nincompoopiest of all. Give credit to Pennsylvania, for example, whose GOP governor, Tom Corbett, recently scored big nincompoop points by explaining why his state ranks 49th in job creation. Many employers, the governor grumbled during a radio interview, say we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed a drug test. Yes, the old my constituents are a bunch of drug addicts, Dodge. That's world-class nincompoopery. Did I mention that Tom's voter approval rating is down to 38%? But compare Corbett to one of the Lone Star State's Congress critters, Steve Stockman. Steve's re-election campaign has put out a bumper sticker with this uplifting thought: if babies had guns, they wouldn't be aborted. Wow, that's two nincompoopisms in only 8 words. Still, even Steve can't hold a candle to Representative Louis Gohmert, the mouth that never shuts. Vice chair of a House Homeland Security subcommittee, Gohmert recently revealed an astonishing piece of intelligence on the terrorist threat to the U.S. of A. Al-Qaeda, he informed the whole world, has set up radical Islamist camps on the other side of the Texas-Mexico border. Really? No. But the Islamist alarmist proceeded to tell us that Mexican drug gangs are teaching Al-Qaeda infidels how to cross the border into Texas. And they're also being trained to, quote, act like Hispanics. Wondered many Latinos on this side. How does Louis think one would act Hispanic? Sing La Cucaracha? Drive a lowrider? Dress up as landscapers? This is Jim Hightower saying, but think is not part of Gohmert's shtick, which is what puts him atop the world of nincompoops.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
This week, the United States government shut down domestic exchanges of the online currency Bitcoin. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has reportedly taken action against the Japanese Bitcoin exchange Mt. Gox. On Tuesday, tech website CNET reported that related actions by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement forced the Iowa-based Dwolla Payment Service to stop making Bitcoin transactions. These two events have effectively shut down domestic exchanges of the Internet's most prevalent unregulated currency. U.S. government officials have voiced concerns that unregulated currencies like Bitcoin are used for criminal activity. While the government actions may limit domestic Bitcoin exchanges, it's not yet clear what effect it will have on international markets, if any. Bitcoin was introduced in the U.S. 2 years ago. It's one of the first uses of a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. The virtual currency can be transferred through a computer or smartphone without an intermediate financial institution. Cryptocurrency, or math-based currency like Bitcoin, uses open-source cryptography in its creation and management rather than relying on central authorities. In recent months, valuation of the nearly 11 million Bitcoin in global circulation surpassed the $1 billion mark.
A group of activists working to save the last wild buffalo in the United States have reported that the United States-funded helicopters have hazed herds of buffalo in Montana. In addition, government-funded cowboys have ridden horses through the herds, disturbing pregnant mothers and newly born calves in an attempt to force the buffalo back into Wyoming. Michael Meese is a representative of the Buffalo Field Campaign.
The last 3 days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the greater Yellowstone ecosystem was assaulted by a taxpayer-funded helicopter, which in those 3 days moved 600 adult buffalo and 250 brand new baby buffalo 10 to 12 miles by force with the helicopter, with ATVs, with horses and 4x4 trucks. And basically all for the livestock industry of Montana's benefit. The state of Montana has a zero tolerance policy of any buffalo coming and staying in our state. They're either hunted during November through February, and then after that the zero tolerance comes when they either capture them and ship them all off to slaughter, or they actually do what they consider the nice thing, which is hazing. And it's running, you know, we're talking about spring in Montana, all the bird migrations that are out here, all the wildlife and fauna, and also the moms are either just about to give birth or just have, and this is the poor introduction that we give these poor animals to life. It's all founded off the unfound myth that these buffalo are going to give back the disease brucellosis, which the cattle gave to all our wildlife in the Yellowstone ecosystem when we brought them over here from Europe. The disease has never been transmitted in a wild situation from bison to cattle. And I mean, the hidden agenda and why this is really happening is public lands grazing and grass in the state of Montana and which animal gets to eat it. And the ranchers of Montana feel that all the national forest, all the land in Montana has belonged to the cattle industry, and our wildlife is subjected to their wrath. Here we have the last wild buffalo we have, and we manage them for minimal numbers. We kill them off if they dare be buffalo and walk into the state of Montana. The Yellowstone buffalo and the Yellowstone ecosystem, period, are a jewel of the world. It's a World Heritage Site, and they're a gift of all of ours, not just the state of Montana. So we're standing up in opposition to the state of Montana and their cruel behavior towards this sacred species, and we'll be here until they're treated like all other wildlife and can just be wild buffalo.
That was Michael Meese with the Buffalo Field Campaign. More information can be found on their website, buffalofieldcampaign.org.
The supposed scandal reported this week involving the IRS may not be a scandal after all. According to some analysts, the office that investigated the applications of Tea Party groups for potential political activity was actually just doing its job. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with analyst Mark Sumner for more on the story.
As we hear about the targeting of Tea Party groups by the IRS or by an office of the IRS based in Ohio, what do you think is missing from the narrative that's been put out in the media on this subject?
I think just from the start, the idea that this was targeting conservative groups is a mistake. We're talking about a group here that was not inserted into politics, but was charged with looking into groups that might potentially be political. These are groups applying for a tax-exempt status that is not supposed to go to political groups. So it seems only right that when they're confronted with a new influx of applications from a group that is overtly political, they should sort those applications into the stack for political groups that should warrant a little more attention.
In looking at the applications, how many of these applications were then ultimately rejected?
Actually, I think the number that were finally rejected is fairly small. We're talking fewer than 30 groups that were rejected. Most often, don't stay rejected, and it really doesn't hurt them. There's no harm, no foul here. When your application is rejected, you don't stop operating as a nonprofit. You can refile your application, which is what most of these groups did.
So do you think that the IRS was actually following the law?
I think the IRS was following the law, yes. I don't think there's anything illegal here at all. I think people have jumped to the conclusion that this was the IRS inserting itself into politics. But like I say, this group in Cincinnati was charged with a job that's political. It's a requirement of their task. Now, I think what everybody has reacted to is that they used terms like Tea Party to say this group deserves extra attention. I'd be very surprised if they were getting groups that said something like Young Democrats, but they wouldn't have also given that group the same level of attention.
If they were following the law, then why has it led to resignations of the IRS chief and other officials?
I think that there's an unfortunate tendency in this administration and in Democrats in general to respond to just the word scandal by acting as if there is one. I think that we're seeing the next round of Shirley Shiraz here, where without any indication that there's real wrongdoing, you strike first and determine innocence later.
Well, how did the Citizens United ruling and this 501c4 designation impact this type of scrutiny?
You know, we're into this really fuzzy area now where these groups can educate on political matters, but they can't go for a candidate. And I think at a time when you had 138 candidates out there running on Tea Party platforms, that it's no mistake that when you see something that says Tea Party show up, that you should assume that it is a political party. With Citizens United and with some of the rulings, you've also got this very fuzzy area where these groups can engage in lobbying, but not to a significant degree, or other kind of gray language like that. So there's no clean lines in here to make these judgments on.
Well, do you think that this will lead to the IRS backing off from enforcing tax laws and that impacting groups that are engaged in political activity?
Yeah, I think that's the real unfortunate outcome of this. You know, if I had my say here, what I would really want is for the IRS to just get tougher on all of these groups. I think that there's some evidence in the report that groups that were engaged in political activity squeaked by and didn't get this extra attention because they didn't include some of these terms. I'd just like to see all groups that are applying for this kind of educational, non-political tax-exempt status to get the scrutiny to make sure that they're not just candidate groups in disguise.
Well, thanks very much. Again, I've been speaking with Mark Sumner, who is a blogger with the Daily Kos Devil's Tower blog. He wrote an article, "The IRS Scandal, All Smoke, No Fire." Thanks for joining us today, Mark Sumner.
Thank you.
This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, filed new legal briefs today in their lawsuit challenging the IRS's approval of 501c4 organization activities that are not directly promoting social welfare. According to federal law, 501c4 organizations can only use their funds for direct social welfare. But some of these organizations engaged in political activity during the last election. CREW is suing the IRS in conjunction with Dr. David Gill, former Illinois congressional candidate, for allowing organizations to anonymously donate large sums of money to candidates and causes under the banner of social welfare. In the 2012 election cycle alone, organizations donated over $250 million towards various campaigns. David Gill himself was the subject of a series of negative campaign ads produced by the 501c4 organization American Action Network, seeking to discredit his campaign by falsely claiming that Gill opposed Medicare. The series of ads, which cost $1.5 million, was funded by health insurance companies which opposed Gill's support of a single-payer national health care plan. The IRS claims that CREW does not have legal standing to file the lawsuit, but today's brief challenged that claim.
Today was Iraq's deadliest day in months, with bomb strikes near Baghdad killing at least 76 people. Today's attacks in Sunni regions brought the region's three-day death toll to 130. The deadliest blast occurred in a Sunni mosque 35 miles from Baghdad. Two explosions in quick succession killed at least 41 and injured another 56. According to the Associated Press, today was the deadliest day in Iraq since September 9th, when 92 people were killed.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Rachel Bennett, Robin Ryan, Sahara Monish, Evan Owen Stively, Ross Freeman Levin, and Jennifer Kemp. The producer is Zeke Harrington. Special thanks to the reporters at Free Speech Radio News. If you'd like to hear more of their stories, you can listen to them at fsrn.org. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott speak with scholar and activist Akinyele Umoja about his book, We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein asks, are we heading for another